Welcome to episode 14 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in our New York office. Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe and in the Washington office. And we're pleased to have guest commentator Ben Wittes, who is formerly a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Lawfare blog, which he has persuaded us to post our podcast to. We're grateful for that. I am a member of the Hoover Institution's Task Force on National Security and Law. I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and holding the record for returning to Steptoe and Johnson's Washington office the most number of times in a career. Let's get started. As is traditional, we'll do This Week in NSA, but This Week in NSA is relatively uneventful. There was a Reuters story that I've spent some time with saying that some researchers from the public cryptography community had discovered something bad about the way NSA influenced the dual elliptic curve random number generator standard. It was a little hard to figure out what was going on in the story, but essentially these researchers looked at the standard, which they believed to be flawed, figured out what the flaw probably was, but couldn't actually decrypt any communications or utilize the flaw, so they made up a similar flaw and looked to see how fast NSA could break encryption if that flaw were the flaw that had been introduced. Pretty hypothetical and pretty clearly aimed at dramatizing a story that hasn't gotten a lot of legs. But when I looked at this, I was struck by two things that I didn't think the story did enough to address. One, it's apparently perfectly clear to people who actually do this for a living that NSA, if it did do something to this standard, didn't weaken it for everybody in the world, as has been suggested. It appears that the only people who may have an ability to utilize this to get access to communications are the cryptographers at NSA. If you talk to experts, they say, yes, it's been done very well, but we think it's there and we think it helps NSA, which is not quite the story we've been getting. The story we've been getting is how terrible it is for Americans that their security has been endangered by NSA tinkering with the standard. And the other thing that was astonishing about this is when the cryptographers went looking for people who had, instances where the standard was being used, they only found on the entire internet 720 servers out of some 21, 22 million that were running secure SSL sites. They could only verify that 720 of them were using this particular dubious standard, or at least RSA's implementation of it, which is where the problems arise. That's strikingly small when you look at all the other internet security problems that are in the hundreds of millions, like Windows XP, which as of today, I believe, is no longer supported, and any security flaws that are found in other Windows products will not be patched for most users from here on out. That's 300 to 500 million users, or just our routers, which have flaws in them that the manufacturers have said, yeah, we're not going to fix that. And those are probably 50 to 70 million flawed routers already on the internet. So 720 didn't seem like more than a drop in a bucket compared to this, especially the amount of attention that it had gotten. So I've blogged on that. I won't spend any more time on it unless somebody else wants to jump in. Other than that, really very little news. Yahoo has announced that it's finally encrypting its back office communications, as some of the other big web services have done. That means that it's not going to be easy, maybe not possible, to intercept communications between data centers that Yahoo maintains. And so the only way to get at Yahoo Mail in an easy way is to go through the process of serving a subpoena on Yahoo, which means that everybody in the world who wants access to that will have to go through the U.S. Justice Department. It's ironic that everybody's shooting at NSA and the U.S. government, but they're actually hitting law enforcement around the world, and that probably is going to lead to more demands that they that the data centers be located in other countries so that they can be subpoenaed there. Jeff Stone, who was one of the expert group that produced a number of recommendations, most of which haven't yet taken, wrote a very nice piece about, he's the only one of that expert group that had not served in government, and he wrote a nice piece about being sure he was going to have to go out to NSA and explain that there's a Fourth Amendment, and being largely won over by their candor and their commitment to the rule of law, which is kind of consistent with my experience there. He ends by saying they have enormous power, and so we can't trust them, but nonetheless, we shouldn't be demonizing them. They have an important job to do, and they're committed to doing it in a way that Americans would generally support. That's pretty much it for NSA. This is a podcast full of returns, and among other things, LabMD is back from the dead, as far as I can tell, or maybe back from the dead. Michael, what's with their filing?
Well, you may recall that a few weeks ago, LabMD had its challenge to the FTC's authority to police cybersecurity rejected by the FTC itself, which is part of the FTC's administrative action against LabMD. The company had also brought a premature petition for review to the 11th Circuit, which the 11th Circuit rejected because the FTC hadn't even ruled yet. And then LabMD had voluntarily dismissed its own lawsuit in Washington, D.C., citing unspecified jurisdictional reasons. And now it's refiled that lawsuit, but this time in Georgia, I guess thinking they'll have a more friendly venue there, although I don't see any reason to believe that. So I think it's still unlikely they're going to...
That is where they did business, right? That was where they did business, if I remember right.
That may be where they're headquartered. I don't know, but they've done business in more than just Georgia. So I think they had lots of places they could have chosen. But to me, this is all just a lot of, noise. I think it's very unlikely they're going to prevail, in their challenge to the FTC's authority. This is an authority that's been exercised for a long time in lots of different areas. Congress has implicitly approved it again and again, any restrictions to it.
But by just not saying no and by reauthorizing the FTC, is that?
Yeah, for decades. So, yeah, there you may get an activist judge who says, no, I think this is too much federal power to have in one agency. But I don't know that would last on appeal. So, you know, I think we're still waiting to hear about the ruling in the Wyndham Hotel and Resorts challenge that makes the same arguments, and that's been pending in New Jersey for a while. I don't know what's taken the judge there so long. She seemed to telegraph, I think, in December that she was going to rule against Wyndham, but she has yet to do so.
All right. So the Wyndham and LabMD may make law, but maybe not quite the law they had in mind.
You have to wonder for LabMD if they regret embarking on this course, or if they are long past the point where they regretted embarking on this course. If you compare the cost of all of these different variations on this litigation to what it would have cost to settle the matter with the FTC like all the other companies did.
So I read that guy, the CEO's book. He's written a book called The Devil Inside the Beltway, and the FTC is the devil inside the Beltway to him. He's a very stubborn guy who's got a view of the world that I think is a little distorted, but not crazy. He thought he was being extorted by the security researcher who found the files, and that the security researcher was somehow in league with the FTC to beat him up over this. He doesn't think any actual harm was done, and that he's just being made an example of. And he has this long discussions with about lawyers we all know that he met with, who mostly told him, you ought to settle this because it's just too expensive to fight it. And it just made him angrier. I don't know what's happening to his company, but he has just dug in on this, and he will go down with all his guns blazing, is my guess.
Well, he's being represented by a conservative activist organization, so they have no interest in settling because their whole objective is to get a ruling that a federal agency has exceeded its authority. So they're going to keep this one, even if they lose.
It'll go forever, I think, or at least until the courts call an end to it. Fair enough. He may be opinionated. He may have a slightly odd view of Washington or this case, but to jam somebody through all of this does have a certain air of unfairness, just because he's stubborn and doesn't believe he's done anything wrong and therefore doesn't want to admit having done anything wrong. It shows you that the exercise of the FTC's authority does have costs for ordinary people who would like to be treated fairly and to have their day in court. All right. Well, speaking of day in court, the banks that sued Target's security assessor had just about a day in court, right?
That might have been a day or two. That was quick, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So last week we reported that two banks that claimed to have suffered losses from the Target breach had filed a lawsuit in federal court in Chicago against both Target and TrustWave, which validated Target's compliance with the PCI standards. And this week, the plaintiffs filed notices dismissing the suit against both defendants. The banks had alleged in the lawsuit that TrustWave, which is a well-known PCI compliance assessor, had also provided security monitoring services for Target and was negligent in the performance of those duties. Among other things, the complaint said that TrustWave had failed to identify vulnerabilities in the network that led to the breach, including scanning Target's network a few months before the breach and finding no vulnerabilities present. This week, shades of Gilda Radner on Saturday Night Live, the bank said, never mind, I'm sorry, I can't do her voice. But it turns out TrustWave did not provide data security monitoring services for Target. The dismissal itself was without explanation, but the TrustWave CEO issued a very public denial that TrustWave provided any services of that type for Target, so one has to think that that's why the case was dismissed. The dismissal was without prejudice, so that it's possible some version of it will be back. And, of course, Target still faces dozens and dozens of other lawsuits. But in an ocean of bad litigation news, Target had one drop of good news, at least for one day.
Yeah, well, or at least its security assessor did. I suspect that they pulled it as fast as they did because they didn't want to be accused of having made false statements in their complaint, and now they can investigate at leisure.
Yeah. Yeah. Would have been nice if they'd investigated it before they sued, but you can't have everything.
Right. Why should they be the only ones who do that? Yes. Okay. One more repeat piece of business. The world's most famous 10-second video performance to attract copyright decisions in the Ninth Circuit had one final, well, maybe not final, but one more judicial appearance. If you remember from our last podcast, the woman who was tricked, according to her, and no one is disputing it, tricked into appearing in The Innocence of Muslims and given dubbed lines that were offensive to Muslims, sued and got a rather strange and maybe good for one trip only decision about her copyright rights, and YouTube was ordered to take down the videos that she appears in. Very recently, she and her lawyer filed asking for damages and an injunction, contempt penalties, if I remember right, against Google, saying they hadn't done enough to get the videos down. Over the weekend, this is the most recent news, Google filed a fairly persuasive document saying that many of the claims in her filing were made up, and that Google was putting 20 actual live human beings on this and working as hard as it could to get these videos taken down. As soon as the weekend was over, the court said, yeah, that's right, we're going to deny this motion. So right now the decision is awaiting a decision about whether to seek certiorari, I suppose, which I suspect is not going to happen. And the likelihood that she will be able to make money off of this, which I thought was one of the reasons for the filing, seems much less likely. So that's this week in retreaded stories. There's some new stories. I thought this was kind of interesting. The Onion router is, for people who are security conscious, well known. For others, you'd be forgiven if you thought it turned your email into spoofed, sarcastic stories about the Internet. In fact, it's called the Onion Router because each message peels off one more layer and delivers your message to yet another router, making essentially your communications untraceable. And it's been used by a lot of human rights groups and a fair number of pedophiles as well. Jason, what's happening with the Onion Router?
Well, it actually would be pretty cool if there was an app that could turn your messages into onion quality spoofs. But as you said, that's not what this does. So as with other technologies, there's nothing inherently wrong with Tor, as the Onion Router is known, and certainly nothing inherently criminal about it. But it's become popular among criminals because of the perception that it provides them with the ability to hide their identity and to remain anonymous. There was a story last week about how law enforcement agencies are having increasing success at identifying criminals who use Tor, despite the fact that they're using it expressly to try to remain anonymous. The story appears to have been prompted by some court filings in a case called Operation Roundtable, which was a Homeland Security Investigations case against a child porn website involving users and administrators from all over the world, that's resulted in 25 arrests so far and the identification of over 250 child victims. And in that case, the agents from HSI, from ICE, were able to identify users and administrators of the site despite the fact that they used Tor to protect their identity. And the primary reason they were able to do this is human error. No matter how good the technology is, it still has to be used by people. And at some point, the users made mistakes and left clues to their identity, like one defendant who logged on to his fake Facebook profile that he used in connection with the website and his real Facebook profile at the same time without using Tor. In any criminal case involving computers, the challenge for law enforcement is to put fingers at the keyboard. That's the phrase that they always use. In other words, to figure out what human being was using a given screen name or a given IP address at any given time to facilitate their crimes. And no matter how good the anonymizing technology is, it always comes down to human error by the users and to old-fashioned detective work by law enforcement agencies. And whenever, as Tor became more popular, when I was at DOJ, it became a source of great concern for law enforcement that they weren't going to be able to penetrate it. And it seems to be the case that whenever something new comes out, there is a bit of a crisis atmosphere among law enforcement agencies that they will not be able to figure out a way around it or a way to investigate people who use the technology. But eventually they figure out how to do it, and it looks like they're increasingly doing that here.
Yeah, it's almost guaranteed. This is why we're never going to engineer our way out of the cybersecurity crisis that we face. People have something that are online to do something. And the security is not what they're online to do. It's what gets in the way of the mission that they've chosen. And so there's always a temptation to skip some security step, or you forget, it's because you've got something else you're trying to do that's more important. So while it's comforting to see that, pedophiles can't get away with this forever, it's less comforting when you realize that exactly the same effect is working on our troops in Afghanistan or the Washington Post when it tries to keep the Chinese out of there now.
Right.
It's just not going to – what we're trying to do now is not going to solve the problem. Well, the other issue that I thought was in the news that was worth talking about was this raft of federal magistrates who are issuing judgments about applications for search warrants for computers in which they tell the government, you can't do it that way. You can't do this 600 restrictions that you have to observe that they're writing into the warrant applications. And apart from the fact that these guys are not even Article III judges, and it seems a little bit presumptuous, I wonder whether doing that is consistent with the usual practice and the proper practice with respect to issuing search warrants. You did a lot of this, Jason. So, what's going on here, and how justifiable is it?
Well, Michael and I could probably do an hour on this topic alone. So, and he should feel free to jump in. But this is this reminds me a lot of in the mid-2000s. There was a magistrate judge who issued an opinion that notwithstanding years and years and years of precedent, that you could not get cell site location authority prospectively without a search warrant. And it went viral.
Right. He became a hero. And I suppose if you're a magistrate, which is not the world's most fun job, especially if you're spending it all reading search warrant applications, the idea that you might go viral is pretty attractive.
Well, it didn't take long. I mean, within 12 or 18 months, that opinion had taken hold, and about 50% of the reported decisions throughout the country were in agreement. And I think that this is starting to go viral, too. This is actually the latest chapter in a story that started in 2009, 2010, with the Ninth Circuit series of opinions in a case called comprehensive drug testing. And in that case, the issue was the scope of search warrants for seized computers, not email. And courts in the Ninth Circuit, according to the CDT case, were told to require the government to use search procedures intended to uncover only information responsive to the warrant, including potentially using an independent third party or other law enforcement agency personnel unaffiliated with the investigation to act as screeners to weed out non-responsive information, and including requiring law enforcement to forswear reliance on the plain view doctrine. So if they're searching for evidence of one crime and they see evidence of another crime in plain view, they would not be able to act on that, no matter how serious the other crime was. Now, initially, the Ninth Circuit made those rules mandatory and later downshifted to making them guidance to magistrates, and that created some uncertainty even within the Ninth Circuit about what the rules were, let alone in other parts of the country. When the CDT opinions first came out, it was a huge concern when I was at DOJ, and having to figure out how to advise prosecutors throughout the country about how to respond to them was a real challenge, and it continues to be a challenge even now, because since CDT, courts have taken dramatically different approaches. You have some, like the Ninth Circuit, which view digital searches as presenting sort of unique privacy challenges and that require the adoption of these rules that, the judges in the Ninth Circuit basically made up. I won't say where they pulled them out of, but they were not pulled out of the Constitution, I'll put it that way. And in other circuits, like the First and the Fourth, view this as, and the Sixth, view this as not that much different from agents executing a search warrant in a physical office looking for a piece of paper, in which they're allowed to look for that piece of paper in every file drawer, in every file cabinet in the office, regardless of how the file is labeled. And they view this as just part of doing investigations in the digital age. What's new, or what's newer, is that over the last year, year and a half, this issue has migrated from search warrants of computers and seized media to search warrants of email accounts. Because as you know, when law enforcement gets issues a search warrant to Google or to Yahoo or Hotmail, they seize the entire email account, and then they look through that email account for things that are responsive to the warrant. They don't ask the provider or someone else to to weed out the non-responsive material. Certainly they don't ask the provider to do it. But there have been a number of magistrates over the last year that have rejected warrants like that as overbroad in the absence of some search protocols that would allow the government to screen out things that are non-responsive. And so you're increasingly seeing CDT-like procedures being required by magistrates when they're evaluating applications to search email accounts. Most recently, there were decisions from a magistrate in D.C., who's a serial opinion issuer in cases like this, and a district judge in Tennessee that illustrate the conflict in the courts in the context of email search warrants. This one D.C. magistrate rejected applications for search warrants for email accounts or seized computers three separate times in the last 4 or 5 weeks, in each case because the government failed to adopt or indicate that it was adopting procedures to limit the scope of the search to data that was responsive to the warrant, and failed to indicate what it was going to do with the data that was outside the scope of the warrant. Earlier in March, he rejected a search warrant application to Apple seeking email and other non-content data. A few days later, he rejected six applications for search warrants for electronic devices for the same basic reason, and about a week or so later rejected four more search warrants. So technically that's 11 search warrants in 1 month by the same magistrate. And the court basically said, you know, the government's not taking the hint that I keep giving. And what the government has to do is provide as he put it, a sophisticated technical overview of how it plans to conduct the search. But in Tennessee, the district judge went the complete opposite way and approved, without any conditions, an application for a search warrant to Yahoo that, like all these warrants tend to, required Yahoo to turn over all the emails related to the two accounts that were under investigation, even in the absence of search protocols like the ones that the D.C. judge was requiring. So for law enforcement, this means that the rules that govern digital searches of email and seized computers are going to continue to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And for providers, it actually could mean that they may be required by a court to do to get in the business of screening.
Oh, that's interesting. So that it might be Yahoo that has to screen this and only provide emails that meet certain parameters.
Well, the D.C. magistrate, who appears to be as activist in this area as any that I've encountered, suggested that if the government failed to adopt its own procedures that he considered acceptable, he'd require the government to tell the providers what it wanted and require the providers to do the screening themselves. I actually think my own view is that the right approach is somewhere in the middle. I think the notion of having a third-party screener and a taint team for every warrant is absurd. I think the notion of requiring providers to do the screening is absurd and unfair and burdensome for the providers. And requiring forswearing plain view is absurd and bad for public safety. I think that, but it's clear that not just this guy in D.C., but other magistrates and other federal judges are increasingly concerned about digital privacy, and they don't want a search warrant for evidence of a particular crime to become a license to search for evidence of any crime. But I think there are ways that judges can exercise greater control over the manner in which the warrants are executed after they're issued, without having to place artificial burdens on the issuance of those warrants in advance.
Yeah, although I guess if I were General Petraeus, I'd be saying, where was this judge when I needed him? Because General Petraeus's affair got blown because his girlfriend sent mean messages to Jill Kelly. I and the government started out investigating whether there was a genuine threat to Kelly or people in the military in Tampa. And then when they were in there reading the girlfriend's messages, they said, hey, wait a minute, she's talking to this general about stuff. Maybe there's been compromises of classified information. And that's how they ended up investigating Petraeus.
Well, I think having spent the better part of a month reading those emails when I was at DOJ, I think that even with some sort of screening procedure in place, those emails would have made it over the line in terms of relevance because they put context to the emails to Jill Kelly. But,
okay.
But as a general matter, I think, if you are, there is a greater risk that conduct unrelated to the warrant is going to come out in when the government's looking for evidence of a crime. Although I would suggest that to some degree that risk exists even in the physical world. The question is, how do you balance the ability of law enforcement to do its job in investigating crimes where digital evidence is critical with the greater potential privacy interests that are at stake when so much private information is contained in one device at one time?
Yeah.
The issue here is that DOJ is saying we don't have to balance anything. We can get the entire email account of the people we're interested in. We can take the whole device, not give it back, not indicate when we may give it back. keep the originals. And this judge, you know, there's a history here which I think needs to be mentioned, which is this judge a few months ago, in a case in which the government sought everything to do with a particular Facebook account, the judge said, you know, this is too broad, narrow it down. The government didn't, so he felt compelled not to reject the warrant, but to save the government's bacon by saying, all right, if you're not going to do it, here are some limitations on how you need to go about searching the account. But next time, you put the limitations in and come to me, or I'm going to have to reject the warrant. Government came back, and in all of these warrant applications, did the same thing. We can get the entire account, no limitations. We don't have to tell you anything about how we're going to search it. And the judge said, you got to be kidding me. And so he rejected the warrant applications and said, you guys are not listening. So I don't know if this is just thick-headedness by these prosecutors or if this is a policy decision by either the U.S. Attorney's Office or Maine Justice. But, you know, you can understand how a federal magistrate, even if he's not an Article III judge, he is empowered with authority to review search warrants. He doesn't consider himself a rubber stamp. And when the government repeatedly ignores very specific rulings that say, you know, don't come back to me with a naked warrant seeking a whole email account or not telling me what you're going to do with the innocent information, he's going to get ticked off. It shouldn't surprise anyone.
That's understandable. But my assumption is that justice must have a strategy for taking his decisions to somebody who is an Article III judge.
It's interesting you should mention that. Technically, those things are not appealable under the law as they exist now. So part of, because they're not necessarily final orders,
right.
And so there isn't a mechanism for appealing that to a district judge or even a higher court. Part of the Justice Department's ECPA reform proposal included some things that are not specifically related to ECPA, but one of the proposals was to change the rules to make it clear that denial of a search warrant application by a magistrate on whatever grounds could be appealed to a district court or a higher authority beyond that. And that proposal is, you know, still a proposal and not the law.
Really? So they could, because there's obviously, you're not going to have a motion to suppress for the government later where they can raise this.
Right.
So the criminal defendants get to raise anything they don't like about the magistrate's decision eventually. This decision by the magistrates never gets reviewed.
It doesn't get reviewed. There are certain times in certain courthouses, a district judge will the court may agree to review it if there's a split among magistrates in the same courthouse. Sometimes the district court will get involved, but that's done informally.
Could the Justice Department go to an Article III judge and said, we'd like you to approve this because we think your magistrate is out of control?
Well, it's funny. That does happen in some context. In the cell site example that I used before, the government in some districts, including one I'm very familiar in because I practiced in it, the government at one point got frustrated with the magistrate who was leading the charge requiring a warrant and went to a district judge independently, not to review the magistrate's decision, but just started taking the applications to the district judge who was more in line with the government's position. And ultimately the left hand and the right hand figured out what each other was doing and it became the uniform rule in the courthouse that you have to go to the magistrate. But there are still, even in that area of the law, there are still some courthouses where the magistrates have different views. And the government has been unable to get the rules clarified even within the same district, let alone from district.
Well, that's embarrassing for the judges who run those districts, I would think.
And the main reason why DOJ wanted, it's as part of its ECPA reform proposal to create a mechanism for these splits or these unfavorable magistrate decisions to be resolved was not just because they want to be able to get evidence to continue investigations, but because it's not fair to anybody to have different rules apply. As I said, within the same district or the same courthouse.
So these magistrates have found a way not just to go viral, but to go viral and be immune from appeal as well. That is a sweet gig if you can get it. All right, it's time for our interview segment, and I'm delighted that Ben Wittes is here. He's been an inspiration to those of us who care about national security by bringing a kind of reportorial and editorial sensibility to the coverage of a whole bunch of national security issues. And we're pleased that he made time to come today. He's testifying before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, I believe, on the AUMF and Section 702, two of the more obscure aspects of national security law, at least they were at one point. To my mind, it's still a little obscure what the connection is between the two. So maybe, Ben, you could give us a little preview of your testimony and why you see those two aspects of national security law as tied together.
Well, when the committee asks you to testify on both, that poses its own connection. And actually, I was initially a little flummoxed by that, sort of why these two together at the same time. And the more I thought about it, the more I concluded that actually, as a matter of either accident or wisdom, there's something to it, and they're actually worth thinking about in connection with one another for three reasons that are sort of interrelated with one another. So the first is that these are both major pillars of current American national security authorization for, major activities. One is the bread and butter of American overseas foreign intelligence collection. The other is the authorizing statute for the entire military confrontation against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And they are both under sudden, one more sudden than the other, but sort of substantial political pressure that causes you to scratch your head and wonder, are we going to have the same architecture a few years from now, authorizing the confrontation with Al-Qaeda that we do now?
Well, the AUMF is the resolution right after 9/11 that authorized U.S. forces to go into Afghanistan to pursue Al-Qaeda wherever they were. And obviously we're getting out of Afghanistan, but we're still fighting Al-Qaeda offshoots and maybe Al-Qaeda. But it's getting harder and harder to say that Afghanistan invasion authorization really supports all the things we're doing, right?
Correct. I mean, I think, it is whether you believe, as a lot of people do, including the president who has said this publicly, that the AUMF should be curtailed and ultimately repealed, or whether you believe, as others, including I do, that it needs to be rewritten more to describe our current reality, it is very hard to look at the authorization of September 2001 and see a good description of the conflict we are currently fighting. And so it has come under pressure both as a result of just age and distance from the reality it purports to describe, but also from the fact that the president very much wants to end the conflict and has talked about that, I think, very earnestly and sincerely. And we are pulling out of Afghanistan, which is the sort of major leg of the conflict that describes. And so, that's the sort of genesis of the pressure on the AUMF, the genesis of the pressure on 702, as, your listeners undoubtedly know, is that we have a whole lot of anxiety about surveillance today as a result of the Snowden disclosures that we did not have, only relatively recently, at least in the same pointed form. And these authorities, actually, unlike the AUMF, they sunset on their own at some point. And so if you don't maintain, the odd thing about the AUMF is that it's a perpetually off, it's there until you take it away. But 702 disappears, I think, in 2017, and of course 215 disappears in 2015, and it requires the maintenance of a certain degree of political support for will and belief in the problem that these programs are meant to address in order for them to stay vital. And so I think you actually have sort of almost opposite trends with respect to these, these statutes. One of them is going out of date and needs a breadth of legislative reform that there isn't a lot of political appetite to do. And one is under kind of political threat and anxiety leading to a certain zeal for political reform that may be, overbroad in a way we're going to regret.
Yeah, although it's interesting. I mean, I think that Tea Party Republicans are uneasy about wiretapping. I'm not sure they're particularly uneasy about sending troops abroad in small numbers to whack Al-Qaeda members in a variety of places.
So, right. I mean, I think the political constituencies that organize around these two statutes in different ways are very different, and they're both complicated and they're both fluid. I think the common thread is we've had a certain set of major legal pillars of the sort of things that we do, whether it's drone strikes, large troop presence in foreign countries, or surveillance. And all of those, or many of those legal authorities, and these are two examples of that, are sort of suddenly on the table in ways that they probably weren't a few years ago.
So 702, of course, was famously described as PRISM at one point, and it's there's consensus among the people who have doubts about 215 that 702, which essentially allows the government to get access to information that touches the United States for intelligence purposes, that's been relatively immune from the criticisms that came from 215, partly because it's clearly effective by most people's measure and because it's mostly focused on communications that are at least outside the U.S., and it's fairly tailored. Where do you see the controversy?
Well, so the controversy is seldom about, Section 702 as such, right? But if you think about the last 20 major NSA stories that have graced the front pages of domestic and international newspapers, they're not actually about 215. They're about routine collection under either 702 or 12333. And so to the extent that there is political controversy today over whether it's okay for World at Warcraft for NSA to reach that platform, for example, or whether PRISM is, controversial, a completely sort of valid exercise of U.S. power vis-a-vis either U.S. persons or non-U.S. persons, to the extent that you think it's okay, not okay for Australia to be conducting surveillance against Indonesia and, sweep in some U.S. Lawyer communications and maybe share those with NSA, you're not actually talking about 215. You're talking about 702 and 12333 collection. And so I think part of the question is while nobody stands up and says, or very few people stand up and say, 702 is not an effective program, the vocabulary for that is to say, the NSA is doing vacuum cleaner dragnet surveillance that runs roughshod over privacy rights everywhere. That needs to be reformed. And that last sentence, whether you frame it as a sentence about 702 or not, is in fact a sentence about 702. So my question is, what happens when, we reach whatever compromise we reach over 215, and then we have to go on to discuss, well, what happens now? Do the people who are upset about 215 say, well, we've solved that problem. Now it's time to,
deal with the DEA.
Right. DEA are just kind of going to go on and, do intelligence. Because we've solved the problem. And I actually don't think that's what's going to happen. Remember, the day 702 passed and went into effect, the ACLU filed suit, not over 215, right? They filed suit over 702. And that was what led to the standing holding in Clapper. And their view is not and has never been that 702 is okay because, it doesn't really touch Americans and it's very much and it's pretty effective. Their view is that it's not okay because it does touch Americans a lot, at least incidentally, and can facilitate some reverse targeting, even though that's not appropriate under the statute. And, you know, so I think the question of, you know, as this debate has moved beyond 215 into a larger debate about, you know, why do we have an NSA and let it do so many things? That question is inevitably about 702, even if the people who are having the conversation don't understand that.
Yeah, that's true. I'm slightly more optimistic about this. First, because there's almost no legislative proposals to get rid of 702 or to seriously rein it in. And many of the objections people have, like, oh, there's a lot of American data in that stuff that you're collecting, is a challenge to the entire intelligence enterprise that we currently run. You really have to imagine either no intelligence or far less intelligence carried out in very different ways to think about ways to cure that problem. And I don't see a lot of appetite to do that.
So I agree with that. And this is why, you know, my great colleague, Bill Galston, who always makes the theoretical point that default options matter. I think that's a premise that has a lot of application here. Right now, the default option is if you do nothing, you have 702, and it would take a heck of a political constituency to pass a reform proposal that really only a very small number of people are agitating for. On the other hand, a few years from now, the thing sunsets. And at that point, it takes an affirmative vote for it not to sunset. And the capacity at that point for a whole lot of mischief from the combined forces of the left, the Tea Party right, and the religious fervor of the converted Jim Sensenbrenner types, I think becomes a potent political force that we should not assume. I'm not saying therefore these authorities will go away. I'm saying don't take for granted that the result of it isn't either. Remember, 702 was hard to pass as an initial matter.
Yes, it's only become easy in retrospect because the president who had opposed it turned around on that and has been generally supportive of it.
Right. And you know, the story of how hard a certain group of people had to work in order to make that law happen has never fully been told, I think. And, you know, and that was in the absence of the Snowden, right, materials.
Do you think we could get Ben Powell on to talk about it now? Or, you know, is he never going to talk about it?
I think, that's a matter between you and him.
All right. Ben, well, you are invited. All right. Well, so one possibility is that, we'll end up, validating 702 by passing a 215 substitute that looks like 702. That's what the HPSE has written. And it has some advantages in that it has the flexibility of saying that we'll just borrow a model that now is less controversial than 215, allowing essentially the government to adopt a program and a set of rules, get the rules approved by the FISA court, and then pursue individual numbers in the context of a program that's been pre-approved, which does strike me as a relatively creative and useful solution to the current problem, and not one that's been all that roundly criticized on the left. The criticism has mostly focused on the fact that the HPSE did not include a role for the court in approving every single identifier that goes in to identify a particular number whose hops we're then going to investigate because it's a suspect number and we want to know who that particular caller is in touch with. Is that your sense about the legislation, that structure may actually turn out to be the structure that survives?
So I think you're going to have a lot depends, honestly, on what the president comes forward as his own legislative proposal. I think it will be difficult for Democrats, and for that matter, Tea Party Republicans, to support legislation that gives the president more latitude on surveillance than he's asking for. And so I think the realistic floor is probably what the administration says it wants.
Well, you can take what the administration says it wants and graft it without too much of a Frankensteinian legislative process on the bill that the House committee has developed, can't you?
They're relatively close, except that the administration statement does seem to indicate individual FISA court approval of individual queries.
But you could do that. You could say, okay, so you approve the product, the program, and then you come in and say, we now believe that these particular individuals meet the requirements of the program, and we're asking you to agree that there is evidence they're agent of a foreign power or whatever the standard is.
Right. I think if this is really where the debate is, you know, coalescing toward, right? You know, then A, we're going to have a bill, and B, it's going to be, you know, the parameters, we're talking about a very limited set of parameters now that are really in play. To me, actually, the really, you know, as Saddam Hussein would say, mother of all questions, actually is not about the legal standards here. The real question to me is, what will the requirements as to the companies holding the data in particular formats actually be in practice? Because if you imagine that those requirements are minimal and don't facilitate very much in the way of you know, replication of the current capability, then there's actually no advantage of this program, whether in the House version or as the administration articulates it, over a bunch of national security letters. They can already give the companies a national security letter without judicial pre-approval or programmatic judicial pre-approval that says, you know, give me all the one hop out from the Stuart Taylor or Stuart Baker, cell phone number.
We may only be two hops from each other.
And, you know, on the other hand, if you imagine that there are requirements that the companies hold this data and maintain this data in the form that allows substantially the same interoperability that allows you to basically do without holding the data what the government is now doing by holding the data, then I'm not sure the difference between the House bill on a procedural level and what the White House is talking about, if in fact there is a difference, is probably all that significant. I think if that's the case, you're actually talking about a big win for NSA that expands the substantive coverage of their program while giving the civil libertarians what they claim to want. I think a huge amount rests on what the technical dimensions of the data formatting component would look like.
Yeah, and obviously it's hard to know exactly what the data formatting challenges are going to be, but I do think that as a practical matter, this is really going to turn what had been a look back into almost exclusively a look forward. And maybe not completely, but, you know, much of the data that the companies keep now, their billing records consist of my billing records. I get a bill for $51 every month for all my calls. They don't care who I called. They don't care, which numbers I called, how much, time I spent on the internet. It's just $51. So there's no reason for them to have any records about the people I called in the past. Once they have verified that I'm still using the phone, they can, and they've connected the calls, they can dump that call record almost immediately.
But isn't there an 18-month regulatory requirement?
And actually, that's a widespread impression. Yes, there is an 18-month requirement that you keep billing records in case there's a dispute. Customer says, I didn't make that call. I shouldn't be charged for that. But if the only bill you get is $51 for having available service, then there's no point in calling them up and saying, you know, I didn't call Seattle because you aren't getting charged extra for Seattle. So the records they're keeping are, was your phone alive and making phone calls? I think. I mean, I don't know the details of this, but it seems to me that their billing records are dramatically simpler than the information that the government would like to have, which means this is not exactly a win for NSA or for the rest of us if we think that this program could prevent terrorist attacks, because it'll be an order that says we'd like to know who this guy is contacting in the future, not in the past.
Interesting. I mean, I think that there is a coverage problem now.
Right.
And
this may be part of it. It may be that the coverage problem is the lack of billing record data as opposed to some of the other possibilities. I've speculated that maybe it was a lack of that they couldn't get the location data out of their mobile phone.
No, I think that's clearly part of the problem too. And it may be that you're swapping one coverage problem for another. Look, it turns out, you know, the fevered imaginations of certain civil libertarians aside, it's actually hard to collect all the metadata in the world and process it in a fact. That's not, you know, that's not something that if you happen to be able to call somebody Big Brother, they're necessarily able to do. And so there may be, you know, there may be coverage gaps. I'm sure there will be coverage gaps in this model too. You know, I continue to think if this is where the conversation ends up resting and we end up with legislative authorization for this capability, that's not a terrible outcome for, you know, the various values that and interests that we have as a society in this question.
Well, fair enough, because if we have to have a big civil liberties fight in the second term of every Democratic administration, or actually every second term administration, as we have had for the last three presidents who got second terms, this is not the worst fight to have had.
Look, I mean, you know, 215 is actually a small program. It's a program that has taken on sort of cosmically large significance in people's mind, but it's a few hundred queries a year.
Right.
You know, by contrast, 702, according to the Washington Post in 2012, was the single largest contributor to the president's daily brief, you know, in 2012. So it's, you know, the bread and butter stuff of U.S. intelligence collection. And so I do think it's, you know, it is a win of sorts for the administration to be fighting this on the 215 grounds at all, rather than, to go back to your earlier point, rather than fighting about the core.
Right. And obviously the people who want to fight about this aren't going to go away, but they can't walk away from this fight. And the longer it goes on and the tougher it is, the less likely they are to pivot to some other fight.
And I was on a panel, you know, a week and a half ago or so with Michelle Richardson of the ACLU, and she expressed the anxiety, which I actually, you know, took a lot of, comfort in, that the result of this would be that we reach a compromise over 215 and, it's a favorable one from her point of view, but that process exhausts the political energy and we in fact don't talk about the larger questions associated with 702. And that sounds like a pretty good deal to me, actually. You know, even if the operational environment in the 215 space is as a result of it not ideal, I do think, you know, you could imagine walking away from this with, you know, a haircut instead of a decapitation.
Yeah, I think that's right. Speaking of Michelle, it reminds me, she still owes me $20 because I bet her early on in this dispute that no more than 1,000 people's records were referred to the FBI in any given year. And it turns out it's a few hundred, but she's never come back and say, oh, gosh, Stuart, you were right. It wasn't as big a deal as I thought. Nor has the ACLU decided that they're going to say it's not that big a deal. Well, thanks very much for coming on today. So thanks, everybody. This has been episode 14 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. I want to thank Michael Battis, Jason Weinstein, and Ben Wittes. We hope you'll join us next week for the insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. And for more information, please visit our website at www.steptocyberblog.com.